that we were getting from CIA headquarters, from NSA, from the FBI, it was all erroneous. And so we thought that this was this terrorist Superman that we were after. We literally dropped everything else that we were doing in Pakistan, and we dedicated a virtual army of men and women to tracking his location. But in the end, none of what we believed had any truth behind it.
And then where was he taken? You said he was taken in an unmarked plane out of Pakistan after being in this military hospital. Where did he go? I mean, just trace his journey. He went to several black sites. And what do you know about what happened at these black sites?
I am sorry to say that 20 years after the fact, the CIA has never publicly admitted or declassified the locations of those black sites. I'll defer to Mark on the specific answer, but I will say that the locations of these various sites have been reported on extensively in the media. I just can't confirm it.
And before we go to Mr. Dembo to talk about not only where he was taken, but these unbelievably horrifying illustrations of Abu Zubaydah, talk about how you came to be aware of what was happening to him. I mean, you were responsible for his capture. And why you decided to go to the media with that, which ultimately led to you being imprisoned.
Well, you know, I'm a firm believer in a couple of things. I'm a firm believer in respect for human rights, and I'm a firm believer in the rule of law. And if the United States, as a government, as a society and culture, is going to go around the world and impose our professed beliefs on human rights upon every other country in the world, if we are going to have anti-torture laws in our country, if we're going to be not just signatories to, but the drafters of the United Nations Convention Against Torture, then by God, we have to live by those words. Right? We have to take that seriously. We're either going to be a shining beacon for the rest of the world on human rights and civil liberties, or we're not. We can't be both. We can't tell other countries to respect civil rights and then ignore, or human rights, and then ignore human rights when it's inconvenient for us to respect them. Abu Zubaydah, I think, is the poster boy for that. Here's a man who we were just simply wrong about. We savaged him in secret. We denied him his constitutional rights to confront his accusers in a court of law. We never charged him with a crime. We know from the Senate torture report that the plan was for him to just die in custody, and then we would cremate him and throw his ashes into the sea. Well, where's the legal justification, or frankly, the moral justification for any of that? Abu Zubaydah, if he was not going to be charged with a crime, should have been released years ago, decades ago. And here we are 21 years later, and he's still imprisoned.
Mark Dembo, you are one of the attorneys representing Abu Zubaydah, and you've just released a report titled American Torturers, FBI and CIA Abuses at Dark Sites and Guantanamo. Explain what's in that report.
Okay. That report was based exclusively on the drawings that Abu Zubaydah made of the examples of the torture he endured, as well as, and this is significant, his descriptions of each of those events. And the descriptions are something that's really never been seen or heard, because they're the descriptions of the torture victim describing the effect of each torture technique. Now, as to the significance of the drawing, one reason they're so significant is it is fully recognized that the CIA had 92 videotapes of his torture. And it's also recognized that a federal judge ordered the CIA to preserve those for purposes of litigation that would be following. It's also undisputed that the CIA knowingly destroyed those tapes in order, as the trailer indicated, It would be to hide the people, protect the people who engaged in that torture. So there's no visual evidence of what they did to Abu Zubaydah. There's only the sanitized descriptions of what types of techniques could be used, most of which were not used the way they would sound. And these drawings are the only source of the application of the torture techniques approved by America's torture program, and they're done by Abu Zubaydah. And he is, of course, the first person the U.S. chose to torture. And the U.S. torture techniques were approved solely to torture him, even though they fully knew he did not and was not appropriately, he didn't warrant any detention. I mean, obviously, the cynical thing is, before the CIA advised the Department of Justice why he should be tortured, the CIA's reasons had already been learned by the FBI, and the FBI formally told the CIA, none of these facts are true, and whatever you're saying is false. And they proceeded anyway.
I want to turn to another clip from the forever prisoner of James Mitchell, the retired Air Force psychologist who is the chief architect of the CIA's torture program. You remember Mitchell and Jessen, the two psychologists. It starts with FBI agent Ali Soufan.
You call this guy Boris. Is Boris his real name?
No. I cannot talk about him, and I cannot even mention his real name.
This is Boris. His real name is James Mitchell. He also wrote a book about the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah. But Mitchell's book had the full cooperation of the CIA, because Mitchell was the inventor of EITs, the acronym for what the CIA called enhanced interrogation techniques, and what the rest of the world called torture.
If my boss tells me it's legal, especially if the president has approved it, I'm not going to get into the nuances about what some guy in the basement or what some journalist thinks about it, because they're free to trade places with me anytime they think they can do a better job of protecting Americans.
Again, that's James Mitchell, the retired Air Force psychologist who helped to design the torture program. Mark Dembo, if you can talk about his role and the role of the American Psychological Association, a very sordid, dark chapter of the largest association of psychologists in the world, and how this actually was implemented and used against Abu Zubaydah. And then describe in detail, we also have a radio audience, the illustrations that have rarely been shown that we are showing today.
Okay, let me start with James Mitchell's claim justifying why he did it. First of all, James Mitchell was hired by the CIA 4 days after Abu Zubaydah was captured. And the CIA had determined that they didn't want the FBI or the Defense Department interrogating Abu Zubaydah. They wanted to keep control of him. Then they hired Mitchell. And people asked, why are you hiring somebody in order to do this interrogation? And the CIA director said, or deputy director, we are in uncharted waters. We've never done this before. Then Mitchell invented the techniques that he wanted to use, claiming they would work. And after he had the techniques approved, then they needed somebody to torture. And they created a person to justify torturing him. And that was Abu Zubaydah. And that's because he was the only human being they had captured, the CIA had captured. He was also the only human being that they had available to torture. And they created a fictitious person described previously as an Al-Qaeda representative, a leader, and so on, and passed that on to the Department of Justice. Department of Justice said, we're giving permission to torture him, assuming these facts are true. In fact, the CIA knew they weren't true, and as I said earlier, had been told by the FBI that they weren't true. So Mitchell, in fact, invented the psychological assessment of Abu Zubaydah. That leads us into the Mitchell relationship and also the American Psychological Association. The only document ever presented to the Department of Justice to justify torturing Abu Zubaydah was called a psychological assessment. This is obviously designed by psychologists, but the one thing missing from the psychological assessment is an assessment. You'd think they'd be talking about the impact of it, how harmful it would be, how it might work, the dangers, and so on. All it does is list 13 salacious facts that are dripping with gore, all untrue, to give to the Department of Justice. So the Department of Justice was duped into believing they really had the mastermind of 9/11. They had the number two Al-Qaeda person. He'd been coordinating worldwide interrogation, terrorist programs, and a series of other things. Every single one of those was false. And every single one of them was determined to be false, including by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. So Mitchell fabricated all of the facts designed to justify torturing him. And bear in mind, he had been interrogated and tortured by Mitchell for 5 months before they gave the CIA, the Department of Justice, this fake description of him. So he invented and fabricated all the facts that allowed them to torture somebody who has now absolutely agreed to have been not any of the bad things that were said about him. Now, about the drawings. First of all, the drawings are really quite gruesome. And in fact, quite a few American news media have not been willing to publish the report of the drawings because they're simply too disgusting. I agree they're disgusting, but of course, I think that's exactly why they should be published. Okay, among the drawings, first of all, keep in mind that nowhere did the Department of Justice say you could keep people totally nude for weeks, months, and maybe years at a time. That's the duration of some of these things is another abuse. For instance, another thing is when they were talking about anal rape, there's a discussion in there of fake anal rape with him bending over on his hands and knees, and they have a broomstick pointing to or touching his anus or near his anus. That's there. And there are guards sitting watching them. And as you go through some of the waterboarding, they would put him in a water shape, a coffin-shaped box, lying down with his hands handcuffed, the water up to his nose, and they would sit there and watch him and then ask and keep track of him. And then when he would go under, they'd push him under, they'd bring him up. That could go on for hours and days. One of the things about these drawings is they do not show the duration of the torture. For instance, the CIA cables show for 17 straight days they cycled through each one of these techniques, the walling, the waterboarding, the confined spaces, the detention, hands and knees locked together so they can't move, the nudity, all of the other things, including hitting and walling. You mentioned walling. Walling turns out to be probably the most physically damaging of all the torture, because they have a man standing right near a very solid wall, about 18 inches away, with his heels kept from moving, handcuffed, and then they stand there interviewing him and asking him questions, supposedly, and then every once in a while they reach up and slam him back so his body goes back and his head hits the wall. And they will do that over and over and over. And what they would end up doing is they would do that for quite a few while. Then they'd have him stand nude in a room with cold room and spray water on him for a long period of time. Then they would put him in a very small box, the size of a box where you could only have your knees together, your ankles together, like a catcher in baseball, with their hands, feet, and needles all stuck together in that box in the dark for an unknown amount of time. Now, of course, the detainee has no clock, no calendar, no days. They don't know how long they're in there. Then they would bring them out, and they would then put them in a larger box. And sometimes they would have them in a larger box, and they would rock the box back and forth while he's there in the dark knowing what's happening. And throughout all this time, of course, there was not only the nudity, but loud music, and they were also threatening to desecrate the Quran. There's a drawing showing that. But ultimately, the drawings are simply a picture of, if these were the approved torture techniques, and they were all approved in a sense, then you have the people who are engaging in it being like freelancers, going off and trying to invent other ways to make it work. Nowhere did the Prudence say you should take a rape, an anal rape with a broomstick. That was their invention. Mitchell gets credit for that one. And the same thing happened when they were talking about keeping him in the water for hours and hours and hours. As he complains, he was in there so long, he couldn't protect himself. And so his body waste ended up, he was in water with his body waste, with his hands and feet shackled with just his nose out of it for an indefinite period of time. So people have to look at all these pictures. And well, this is maybe the only place where anybody will ever get to see them. They won't get to see the CIA video.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Mark Dembo. And I want to end with one final quick question to John Kiriakou. You went to jail for 23 months. Would you do it again to expose what happened to Abu Zubaydah, going to the media and revealing this?
In a heartbeat. I would do it again today. And I'll tell you the truth, Amy, my only regret is that I didn't go far enough all those years ago. I should have been more clear. I should have ignored nuance. I should have just come out with everything. I would do it again in a heartbeat.
John Kiriakou, CIA torture program whistleblower, worked at the CIA for over a decade. Mark Dembo, lawyer for Abu Zubaydah, Seton Hall professor. We'll link to your new report, American Torturers, FBI and CIA Abuses at Dark Sites and Guantanamo. Coming up, the CEO of the company behind ChatGPT warns Congress about the dangers of artificial intelligence. Stay with us. Amalan jota sidi jar jar sota wi albi abtan tula kasan jehta alfula albi amalan jota sidi jar jar sota Prominent Sudanese singer Shaden Gardoud was killed in crossfire between the Sudanese army and the paramilitary rapid support forces in Omdurman city Friday, despite an agreement between the two warring sides to protect the civilians. Hundreds and hundreds of civilians have died. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. As more of the public becomes aware of artificial intelligence, or AI, the Senate held a hearing Tuesday on how to regulate it. Senate Judiciary Subcommittee Chair Richard Blumenthal opened the hearing with an AI-generated recording of his own voice, what some call a deep fake.
And now, for some introductory remarks.
Too often, we have seen what happens when technology outpaces regulation. The unbridled exploitation of personal data, the proliferation of disinformation, and the deepening of societal inequalities. We have seen how algorithmic biases can perpetuate discrimination and prejudice, and how the lack of transparency can undermine public trust. This is not the future we want.
If you were listening from home, you might have thought that voice was mine and the words from me. But in fact, that voice was not mine. The words were not mine. And the audio was an AI voice cloning software trained on my floor speeches. The remarks were written by ChatGPT. When it was asked how I would open this hearing.
Google, Microsoft, and OpenAI, the startup behind ChatGPT, are some of the companies creating increasingly powerful artificial intelligence technology. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman testified at Tuesday's hearing and warned about its dangers.
I think if this technology goes wrong, it can go quite wrong. And we want to be vocal about that. We want to work with the government to prevent that from happening. But we try to be very clear-eyed about what the downside case is and the work that we have to do to mitigate that. It's one of my areas of greatest concern, the more general ability of these models to manipulate, to persuade, to provide sort of one-on-one, interactive disinformation. We are quite concerned about the impact this can have on elections. I think this is an area where hopefully the entire industry and the government can work together quickly.
This all comes as the United States has lagged on regulating AI compared to the European Union and China. For more, we're joined by Mark Rotenberg, Executive Director of the Center for AI and Digital Policy. Mark, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Now, it's very significant that you have this AI CEO saying, please regulate us. But in fact, isn't he doing it because he wants corporations to be involved with the regulation? Talk about that and also just what AI is for people who just don't understand what this is all about.
Well, Amy, first of all, thank you for having me on the program. And secondly, just to take a step back, Sam Altman received a lot of attention this week when he testified in Congress. But I think it's very important to make clear at the beginning of our discussion that civil society organizations, experts in AI, technology developers have been saying for many, many years there's a problem here. And I think it's vitally important at this point in the policy discussion that we recognize that these views have been expressed by people like Timnit Gebru and Stuart Russell and Margaret Mitchell and the president of my own organization, Merva Hycock, who testified in early March before the House Oversight Committee that we simply don't have the safeguards in place, we don't have the legal rules, we don't have the expertise in government for the rapid technological change that's now taking place. So while we welcome Mr. Altman's support for what we hope will be a strong legislation, we do not think he should be the center of attention in this political discussion. Now, to your point, what is AI about and why is there so much focus? Part of this is about a very rapid change taking place in the technology and in the tech industry that many people simply didn't see happening as it did. We've known problems with AI for many, many years. We have automated decisions today widely deployed across our country that make decisions about people's opportunities for education, for credit, for employment, for housing, for probation, even for entering the country. All of this is being done by automated systems that increasingly rely on statistical techniques. And these statistical techniques make decisions about people that are oftentimes opaque and can't be proven. And so you actually have a situation where big federal agencies and big companies make determinations. And if you went back and said, well, like, why was I denied that loan? Or why is my visa application taking so many years? The organizations themselves don't have good answers. So that was reflected in part with Altman's testimony this week. He is on the front lines of a new AI technique that's referred to generally as generative AI. It produces synthetic information. And if I could make a clarification to your opening about Senator Blumenthal's remarks, those actually were not a recording, which is a very familiar term for us. It's what we think of when we hear someone's voice being played back. That was actually synthetically generated by Senator Blumenthal's prior statements. And that's where we see the connection to such concepts as deep fakes. This doesn't exist in reality, but for the fact that an AI system created it. We have an enormous challenge at this moment to try to regulate this new type of AI, as well as the pre-existing systems that are making decisions about people, oftentimes embedding bias, replicating a lot of the social discrimination in our physical world, now being carried forward in these data sets to our digital world. And we need the legislation that will establish the necessary guardrails.
Mark Rotenberg, can you elaborate on the fact that so many artificial intelligence researchers themselves are worried about what artificial intelligence can lead to? A recent survey showed that half, 50% of AI researchers give AI at least a 10% chance of causing human extinction. Could you talk about that?
Yes, so absolutely. And actually, I was... You know, one of the people who signed that letter that was circulated earlier this year was a controversial letter, by the way, because it tended to focus on the long-term existential risks, and it included, you know, such concerns as losing control over these systems that are now being developed. There's another group in the AI community that I think very rightly said about the existential concerns that we also need to focus on the immediate concerns. And I spoke, for example, a moment ago about embedded bias and replicating discrimination. That's happening right now, and that's a problem that needs to be addressed right now. Now, my own view, which is not necessarily the view of everyone else, is that both of these groups are sending powerful warnings about where we are. I do believe that the groups that are saying we have a risk of a loss of control, which includes many eminent computer scientists who have won the Turing Award, which is like the Nobel Prize for computer science, I think they're right. I think there's a real risk of loss of control. But I also agree with the people, you know, at the AI Now Institute and the Distributed AI Research Institute, that we have to solve the problems with the systems that are already deployed. And this is also the reason that I was, frankly, very happy about the Senate hearing this week. It was a very good hearing. There were very good discussions. I felt that the members of the committee came well prepared. They asked good questions. There was a lot of discussion about concrete proposals, transparency obligations, privacy safeguards, limits on compute and AI capability. And I very much supported what Senator Blumenthal said at the outset. You know, he said we need to build in rules for transparency, for accountability, and we need to establish some limits on use. I thought that was an excellent place to start a discussion in the United States about how to establish safeguards for the use of artificial intelligence.
And Mark Rotenberg, what are the benefits that people talk about with respect to artificial intelligence? And given the rate, as you said, at which it's spreading these rapid technological advances, is there any way to arrest it at this point?
Well, there's no question that AI, I mean, broadly speaking, and it's, you know, of course, it is a broad term, and you know, even the experts, of course, don't even agree precisely on what we're referring to. But let's say AI, broadly speaking, you know, is contributing to innovation in the medical field, for example, big breakthroughs with protein folding. It's contributing to efficiency and administration of organizations. Better ways to identify safety flaws in products and transportation. I think there's no dispute. I mean, it's a little bit like talking about fire or electricity. It's one of these foundational resources in the digital age that is widely deployed. But as with fire or electricity, we understand that to obtain the benefits, you know, you also need to put in some safeguards and some limits. And you see, we're actually in a moment right now where the AI techniques are being broadly deployed with hardly any safeguards or limits. And that's why so many people in the AI community are worried. It's not that they don't see the benefits, it's that they see the risks if we continue down this path.
Well, we want to talk about what those safeguards need to be and dig further into how it is that artificial intelligence could lead to the extinction of humans on Earth. We're talking to Mark Rotenberg, Executive Director of the Center for AI and Digital Policy. We'll do part two. Put it online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM in Burnaby, British Columbia. Simon Fraser University Campus Radio. Streaming on the internet at www.cjsf.ca.